We have the four cases this morning, and the first is United States versus Stafford, number 19-3833. And we'll begin with you, Mr. McMahon.
Yes, thank you very much, Your Honor. John McMahon appearing on behalf of the appellant, Khalil Stafford. And Your Honor, if it pleases this court, it was my intention to begin with the juror issue specifically.
That's fine. Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Thank you for reminding me, Your Honor. Yes. Could I reserve 3 minutes?
Absolutely. Go right ahead.
Thank you very much. Your Honor, the issue really here is that on the eve of deliberations, three of Mr. Stafford's were deliberating or potentially about to be deliberating jurors were excused with no legitimate basis in the record that can be identified. And I think it's very important just to look at.
Let me stop you. We'll stop you there, Mr. McMahon. We're reviewing this for abuse of discretion. Is that right?
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor.
And so you're telling me there was absolutely no legitimate reason, notwithstanding the court's voir dire of the jurors?
That is exactly what I'm saying to this court, Your Honor.
Okay. So I make sure I understand your argument.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think it's very important to look at where this all began. This began with the court on the morning that there was deliberations were going to begin. The only thing that was remaining was the government's rebuttal summation. And the judge called everyone in and said that there'd been an incident that was reported to her by the marshals. This is critical. She said to the counsel that the marshals had informed her that there was a discussion on one of the vans that contained some of the jurors, and that that discussion revolved around a juror indicating that she had a communication with her sister that morning, either by Facebook or some other electronic means, and that the sister reported either that she herself had been a juror on a case where a guilty verdict was returned, and later it was turned, the person was found not guilty or determined to be not guilty, and or someone that the sister was close to. That conversation never occurred, and we learned that through the voir dire. But what happened at that point was the government, before any voir dire, moved to strike both of those jurors, saying that, one, they violated the court's instructions. Clearly, they did not. As we stated in our brief, all the court ever advised the jurors was they could not discuss this case. They were free to discuss any other matter, anything of common interest to them. So one, that was never correct. And no one ever eventually argued that that was the case.
But if you do that by the court, the evasiveness of jurors, and if we credit the district judge's finding that they were evasive, isn't that a legitimate basis on which we can't find an abuse of discretion?
If the court was correct in that finding and the evasiveness did in fact give rise to a legitimate concern, then yes, Your Honor. But what I'm saying to the court is neither of those things are correct.
But aren't we entitled to look at the district court's credibility finding and give it deference? I mean, the district court judge was the one who was in the room with the people. She's the one who spoke with the jurors, and she found them to be evasive. Shouldn't we give deference to her credibility finding or her determination on that?
The record doesn't bear out her finding, Judge. And I acknowledge in my brief that that's a very difficult thing to do. And Your Honor brings up a good point. We weren't in the room. So we know there's a lot more than language that goes into any of these things. But if I could just point something out that I think is critical here, Your Honor. And I'm gonna speak to juror number five on this issue, because that's one of the jurors that the judge really honed in on this theory of evasiveness. At page 3161 of the record, and in commenting about juror number five, the judge found her evasive because she didn't reveal the conversation about the other systems of justice initially, and that had to be drawn out of her. That's not correct. If we just go back a few pages in the record to page 3122, in answering the judge's questions, trying to answer the judge's questions, juror number five said, would you consider one of the statements what our legal system is here. Like, she wants to tell her about that conversation. And the judge says, no, no, I'm not interested. And then what happens when we get to page 3124 of the record? That juror number five again volunteers to the judge, but you don't want to hear about the books and somebody mentioning juror service in another country. And then finally the judge lets her discuss that. So if I could just take one more step back, Judge, to where I was beginning, which is when the judge was initially questioning these jurors, she was doing it in her mind that there was a conversation that someone's sister had related information. We know from all of the jurors that conversation never took place. It's understandable. The marshal's driving the van. He can't keep track of these conversations. He's wrong. So when the voir dire comes out, we find out he's wrong. But at the beginning of the voir dire, the judge was concerned. Why isn't anyone telling me about this conversation? No one was mentioning the conversation because the conversation never occurred. So what the judge was seeing as evasiveness was probably, quite frankly, confusion on the part of these jurors as to what's going on.
Let's assume this conversation or this alleged conversation took place pre-trial and they were picking the jury. Could the judge have excused these folks for cause?
Judge, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And if I could just draw the distinction. What the judge said, which was very disturbing at some level, was that she was concerned that someone who discussed the fact that innocent people are sometimes wrongfully convicted would not be eligible to serve. The question that needs to be asked after that, Judge, is, well, knowing that, which, by the way, we all know, but knowing that, would that affect your ability to serve in this case? Because, Judge, if I could honestly say, sometimes the juror will say, yes, that's too much for me. Yes, I can't do that. I can't have someone's life in my hands. I've picked many jurors. Sometimes that happens. But most times a juror is going to say, no, I know that happens, but you know, we're here to make sure it doesn't happen. And quite frankly, that is why they are here. So for a jury—
Before we go on to the next issue, let's just assume, even though it's a very steep uphill climb, that the district court abuses discretion in replacing these jurors, in particular juror number five. What's the appropriate remedy you're asking for?
I'm asking for the case to be reversed and remanded back for a new trial, Judge.
And there's no way you could, we don't know what juror five would do. So aren't we then in harmless error land?
Judge, I don't see, and I understand that question completely, because I understand, how can I say to this court that the result would have been different, right? I can't read anyone's mind either. But what I will say is there was no basis to excuse her. The defense attorney had indicated, remember, we're through summations, that this was a juror that was favorable to the defense in his opinion, and no one disputed that. No one said, you're crazy. I watched that juror. How do you even think of that? Any of us have tried cases, we know. One thing we know, at the end of the case, when you sum it up, you know the people who are listening to you and maybe for you, and you know the people who aren't. So
you don't know that. That's your best guess on your best day. You don't know that. Nobody knows that. Come on.
That's the best that anyone can ever do, though, isn't it, Judge?
But you don't know. But there's a giant leap of faith there. You don't know.
Well, the reality, Judge, is I think we need to go back to United States versus Penn, where this court cited United States versus Pineda. And if there's no legitimate basis for the judge's excusal of these jurors, then I think there needs to be a remedy. As many circuits have said, there's no, you know, absolute, like,
McMahon, can you cite any case in this circuit, any Third Circuit case, where the court found an abuse of discretion in a decision to remove or retain an existing juror, or where that was done and the remedy that you're seeking, a new trial, was granted?
No, Your Honor.
Maybe that's a good segue to the second issue, the instructions. Now, your defense theory at trial was that this was Mr. Stafford was a purely nonviolent peacemaker when he arrived on the scene. And yet now you're trying to say that there's an alternative theory that he was so caught up in the heat of passion that he only committed manslaughter rather than murder. Those appear to be diametrically opposite. How do you reconcile those two?
Because, Your Honor, in this case, the judge instructed the jurors that they needed to find Mr. Stafford guilty of murder as it exists in the state of New Jersey. In the state of New Jersey, it is absolutely clear, and I provided the court with the case law, that if the elements of passion provocation are present, the court has an obligation to charge that element, because that's an additional element that needs to be actually disproved by the government here. And it has to be charged even if it's contrary to the defendant's testimony. Here, he testified. And let's just think about that. And it makes logical sense. And in New Jersey, that's what the courts say murder requires. Mr. Stafford testified. Jurors don't believe him. His story makes no sense. Okay, what do we do? Doesn't find him guilty just because his story doesn't make sense. We revert to an analysis of the government's proofs. When we look at the government's proofs, their proofs were, by the way of Terrell, their main witness, that when he encountered Mr. Stafford after a gun had been pulled on him by Ian Williams, that he was in a heated state, that he was upset. That's what he said. He said heated moment, upset, that he just wanted to go back to the scene and confront him. And it was Terrell that said, we have to have guns. And when they went back, that again, a gun was pulled on him before anything happened.
Mr. McMahon, are you suggesting that in all cases, or cases in New Jersey at least, that a federal judge would need to independently consider lesser included offenses to the crime? I mean, that seems awfully broad, and to put a lot of obligation on the judge when it's something that even the defense didn't request.
Well, Judge, I understand I'm asking you to review this under plain error. I understand that. But Your Honor, with regard to your question here, this is critical for, and I can, let me just step back. When you say lesser included offense, yes, it is, but it's more than that. It adds an element to murder that must be disproved by the government here if my client is to be convicted of murder under New Jersey law. And that's what is being charged, New Jersey law. And we're
well, the government made an argument 2 days ago in its April 19 submission to us that based on the Sixth Circuit opinion in Fowler and our 1979 decision in Forsyth, that a provocation instruction, which is the, in effect, the heat of passion, could not have been available here because there's no such thing as a lesser included offense. So you're saying, okay, that may be correct. This is not a lesser included offense. It's an element. How in the world is it an element?
It is an element, Judge. Under New Jersey law, it's an element that the state must disprove, that the person acted in the heat of passion with reasonable provocation. So that is an element of murder in New Jersey when these facts are apparent.
It might be an element in New Jersey, but how is it a predicate RICO violent offense as the statute's written?
Because what would happen if it was correctly charged is the jurors would have been advised that they had to make that additional finding as part of their murder finding, which is specifically, has the government disproved that one of the four elements of, and if they say, no, they didn't, then it would be a not guilty verdict on murder and the RICO and the Vicar counts would fail.
But isn't that reading language into the statute? It's not there.
New Jersey's murder statute is comprised of both the statutory language and the case law, Judge. That is, and that's what we're talking about here. The law of the state of New Jersey.
I understand that.
That's one thing I'm familiar with. So I know that, clearly, and that's what would be required.
All right, why don't we hear from Mr. Ramsey and we'll get you back on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Richard Ramsey on behalf of the United States. I guess I would start with counsel's suggestion that there's an element of provocation in the murder statute in New Jersey. And I don't think that's correct. That is a part of the manslaughter statute, but murder doesn't require you or doesn't require the government to disprove provocation. So that's the first thing. But just big picture here, I think the record allows this court to affirm Stafford's conviction for two straightforward reasons relevant to this argument. The first is that even if Mr. Stafford never invited or waived the instructional error he now claims, he can't show that there was a rational basis for the instruction, and he can't show that no rational jury would have convicted him for federal murder based on the evidence at the trial.
Were you the trial attorney here?
I was one of the trial attorneys, yes, Judge.
One of the things, just at the outset, I know you stated in your brief, or whoever wrote the brief, that somehow the instructions that were submitted to the court were joint instructions. But when we looked at it, it appears that they were submitted by the government. And did you indicate to the court that they were the result of a collaborative effort?
We asked the court a few days before that we submitted the charges. We asked the court whether the court would be interested in the charges. The government did take a lead in drafting the charges. The government also provided those charges to defense counsel before even submitting them to the court. And in several parts of the record, the defense counsel made a record of saying, hey, we looked at these instructions, we're working on them, and at the end told the court that they agreed with the instructions except for a few points.
All right. Now you sent us two letters in the last week or so, one on April 13th and one on the 19th. In the one of 13th, you argued that Stafford could have pursued a heat of passion defense only by testifying untruthfully.
Correct, Judge.
But we allow defendants to pursue inconsistent theories, do we not?
We do, but the Supreme Court has put a limitation on the extent of inconsistent defenses. If there's an inconsistent defense that requires untruthful testimony, the court puts a cap on that. The Supreme Court puts a cap on that.
But in New Jersey, in the State versus Powell, didn't the New Jersey court say that provocation manslaughter instruction was appropriate even when the defendant testified that he had an alibi and was not involved in the homicide? That seems to allow inconsistent and perhaps even a testimony that is would be committing perjury.
That would be true in before the statute was enacted I should back up and say Mauricio and Cristano, I believe is the other case in New Jersey, they required the defendant to, or the court to assess whether or not there was a rational basis for the instruction. And so just because that there was inconsistent defenses in the Powell case, that case really is no longer relevant after the enactment of a statute that says, hey, you need to have a rational basis for this instruction.
Let me go back to the first issue for a minute, Mr. Ramsey. Counsel has argued to us that this purported conversation on the van never took place. Is that your understanding of the record?
That's not my understanding at all, Judge. The U.S. Marshal came to the court and relayed a conversation that he overheard, and the court took that under advisement. She advised the attorneys of what the scope or the likely scope of the conversation. She didn't know, none of the parties knew, and an inquiry was conducted with everyone's consent. And so for counsel to say now that this conversation never happened, even after jurors said on the record that a conversation did happen and it took a while for them to get there, but three jurors heard the conversation.
I'm going to ask you the same question I asked your opposing counsel. Let's assume that the district court abused its discretion, and I realize you don't agree with that, but just assume for the moment that it abused its discretion in replacing at least juror 5. What would the appropriate remedy be?
The appropriate remedy in this case is replacing the jurors.
I mean, at this point, appropriate remedy be?
If it was improper and the defendant could show prejudice, then it would be a retrial.
But the point you're saying, you don't have to show prejudice based on a hunch that juror five appeared to be listening in such a way that that particular person might have been favorable to Mr. McMahon's client.
That's correct, Judge. And I do want to point out that it is troubling to me that that assumption is made, and the only reference or the only basis for that assumption is the fact that the juror was African-American. That's what the briefing suggests. And it's not something that I think this court should sanction or allow an interpretation simply because of someone's race, that that person is going to be leaning one way or the other.
They did say the person was nodding in agreement at times. I mean, to be fair, right?
I do not know whether, I have not seen it in the record that the person was nodding. I think the only reference was to the fact that she was African-American.
Yeah. You know, when you have somebody with the experience that Ms. McMahon does, there's a sixth sense you get with respect to jurors. And his impression almost from the outset was that this particular juror seemed to be listening in a way that he had a real chance of getting this particular person on his side. Now, you know, that and 50 cents in a small Midwestern town might not get you a cup of coffee, but you have to give somebody with that kind of experience some deference because he's done it for so long.
Well, Mr. McMahon wasn't trial counsel, Mr. Mindy was, and I can't speak for Mr. Mindy's impressions, but it's pure speculation at this point, Judge. I mean, we picked jurors, both sides picked jurors who were designed to be fair and impartial. That was what we thought, and that's what we thought we were getting throughout the trial. And the suggestion is, or the defense counsel's comments, both now and at trial, beg the question of whether they actually thought they were picking jurors that were going to be fair and impartial. That's the whole system.
And simply because someone is nodding doesn't mean that they agree with everything you say, or that they can't be persuaded otherwise when they're in the privacy of a jury room talking with other folks, right?
Correct, Judge. And at the end of the day, this conversation is really fraught with jury nullification. We're talking about a fear that jurors, or at least one juror, decided one day to bring to the attention of other jurors, and other jurors engaging in that conversation in some way, minimal or not. So, you know, the judge had every right to be suspicious of the fact of whether or not these jurors at this point in the trial could be fair and impartial based on that simple conversation.
And I take it in this case, the alternate jurors were presented with all the evidence. They were presented with the charge, and they were appropriately instructed when they served as the actual jurors, correct?
That's correct, Judge. They were there from the very beginning.
And both sides agreed that these folks would be the alternate jurors.
That's correct, Judge. And I would add too that when the government moved to strike the two initial jurors, the two jurors that that the marshal mentioned were part of this conversation, the government didn't know who the jurors were. We moved to strike based on this idea that jury nullification could be part of the reason, or could be the long-term effect of having jurors on a panel that are already thinking about whether or not they would be afraid of convicting someone because this person might be innocent.
Any further questions from my colleagues?
No,
thank you.
Okay. So let's hear back on rebuttal, Mr. McMahon.
Just briefly before I get back to the juror issue, I just want to make mention of this. There is no statute that has overruled Mauricio or Powell in the state of New Jersey. That's good law. There's no statute that has overruled. I need to say that. But I do want to go to this juror issue now for a number of reasons. One, it is correct. I wasn't the counsel. I cite the trial counsel's comments in my brief where he basically says, I'll start with juror number five, an African-American woman who I would submit to the court has seemed receptive to the defense's theory of the case and our message. I think the government has recognized that. So basically, he's making a statement based on observations made in the courtroom that no one contradicts. Another issue is, the race is important, not because every Black juror is going to be for a Black defendant. Believe me, I know that's not true, okay? Just like every white juror is not for a white defendant or against a Black defendant. But it did reduce the amount of African-Americans on the jury by either a third or half, depending on whether there were originally three or originally
two. But that type of Batson argument was never made.
It was never made, Judge. But I think it's important to note here. I think it's real. And I think what's more important is this. The government's contention that because jurors are having a conversation, and just go back to, it was the judge in her initial instructions when they first all got together who said, we have the greatest system in the world, this jury system. And when these jurors on that van were having that exact conversation, how much better this is, how there was a case in Spain where someone was wrongfully convicted. And that's not a good thing. There was never a cyst or anything like that. A conversation about another system of justice where we don't have jurors. That makes you disqualified to be a jury? No, that makes you qualified to be a juror. That's what we want from our jurors.
Did the conversation take place or not? I heard you to tell us that it didn't take place.
The conversation about somebody's sister never took place. When we heard about it, Judge, and I have it in my brief. I detail it with each juror, what they said. It was a conversation about how our system of justice is better. That juror number, I believe it was 10, mentioned Spain and this incident in Spain. Somebody who wasn't excused mentioned there's no jurors in India. The conversation was fine. No one ever asked these jurors on the voir dire, hey, the fact that someone was wrongfully convicted in Spain, would that have any effect on you here? Because guess what the answer would have been? Absolutely not. How could it have? So three jurors were excused, three jurors who embraced the concepts of justice we want embraced. And that's wrong. And there was no legitimate basis for that decision. Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions from colleagues? Judge Nuyaka?
No, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel for being with us today. And we'll take the matter under advisement. Very much appreciated.